I said last week that rituals and devotion, these were my topics. This one and next month's, these were the topics I wanted to talk about more than anything else. Because I think sometimes we don't think of our lives as rituals and devotion as part of our ordinary life, because a lot of us don't even think, oh, I don't even do that. That's why I was so glad Lindo came and talked. I don't do that. That we had a teacher meeting and she was like, yeah, I don't think I can talk on this. And I said, oh yeah, you're the one that needs to talk on this. Because I have ritual and devotion. Next week, we're going to talk about it all over the place. I create little ceremonies for everything. But I want to talk about why I think rituals and devotion are so important for Dhamma practice. That's why I wanted to talk about this as part of our everyday life. And the main sort of point is trying to understand, we're trying to understand something that is way beyond our understanding. I mean, that's it. This is the problem with the Dhamma, as opposed to mindfulness. So mindfulness has a ordinary connection to it. It has a, it's turned into a fad, a trendy thing. You could bring mindfulness into anything. You can be a better worker if you just have some mindfulness. You can, you know, shoot, cars. I've seen car advertisements that have a little mindfulness in it. So there's a little bit of, all you have to do is buy this car and you can get mindful. So it's as if we have taken mindfulness, this act of paying attention and being, paying attention to unify the mind. And we've taken that, process that the Buddha pointed out that leads to the cessation of suffering, and we put it in our ordinary understanding. It's not bad. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But ordinary understanding is not what awakening is pointing to. Awakening is pointing to something way outside of the ordinary. It is mundane, but it is on a level that's super mundane. So when we take something like mindfulness and we put it and package it up in the ordinary understanding, then in a way, our natural inclination towards the ego tries to control our mindfulness. And that's a lot of what I see in mindfulness circles. It's all about, how do I control my environment so I'm peaceful and calm? How do I control myself? Control, control, control. But I want to, I did this weekend with Port Townsend on Nibbana. And there's a sutta. I don't know if I told you guys this last week, but there's a sutta that the Buddha explained Nibbana in a way that I think points to why we need devotion and rituals as part of our practice. He was with his monks and he's walking and he picks up a bit of dust, he says, on the tip of his finger. So he's got a bit of dust on the tip of his finger. And so he asked the monks, which is greater? The bit of dust on the tip of my finger or the great earth? Kind of like a trick question. But they did good. They knew that the great earth was much bigger than this little bit of dust. And he said, the Buddha said, that our understanding or the mass of our suffering before enlightenment is like the bit of dust on our on his finger. And the liberation after enlightenment is like the great earth. Now, this is a little topsy-turvy for me, because I was telling the room that what I think of when I think of liberation, when I think of the amount of suffering I have gone through, and I have gone through a lot, that is the great earth. And this idea that I can liberate myself from suffering is more like the bit of dust on his finger. And when I read that sutta, that he was comparing my suffering that I have gone through, all of the mess I have gone through in my life, that the level of freedom I could experience if I unbind the mind, if I release the clinging in my mind, is as big as the earth itself. This is something that's like a game changer to me. I don't know how I would be able to envision that as a possibility without some level of trust, without some thing that would keep me on a path that in order to even get to that level of freedom, I got to go through dukkha. Somehow or another, I have to have a path that's going to help me stay there. And this is what I think devotion and rituals do. They bring a quality of beyond me onto the path. And so even though what is asked of this path goes against the grain of society, it goes against the grain of our own egos, it goes against the grain of what we were raised with, what we were taught. A lot of what is asked on this path goes against everything that we think of in our ordinary lives. We have to have something that comes before us or supports us in order to be able to trust that which is beyond us. That's what I think rituals and devotion do. I do not think there's any set way that rituals have to be. They can show up however we want them to show up. But there are a couple of possible pitfalls that I think we can run into with rituals that that connects to this devotional aspect can be both devotional and it can be a pitfall. So the first is in our identification with ourselves. One of the ways that you can begin to see that you are freeing your mind is when you can begin to let go of a sense that you are a permanent self. That is the weirdest thing in the world to talk about, because I know for a fact that Tuwere is sitting in this seat right here. That's my name. And I know what I look like. I know my body. I feel it. And I know that there are other beings both in the Zoom and in this room, and we are not all glued together. So when we say that I am not a permanent self, what we are pointing to is that every minute has the possibility of being freer than the minute before. So I could be very angry when I walk into this room, but I don't have to be very angry 2 minutes after I enter. That there is no, I am not what my parents claimed I was. My father was a hot mess, and if I were his image of me, it would be pretty bad. And I carried around his image of me for a long, long time. But that is not who I am. I don't even know if I ever was that. It's just an image that he created and he decided that's who I was. And I believed it for a long time, but it's not true. So this idea that I'm not a permanent self means that there is an understanding of you that what is possible can change in any moment, and that I am not wedded or tied to a culture, a gender, a femininity, a personality, a who I am. But in order for us to actually, I think, be free with this, is everything in our lives have to be sacred. Everything has to show up in a way that's sacred, so that however I am being in any given moment becomes a sacred act of practice. So if I'm irritated, it's not that I'm a grumpy person or an irritable person. It's that in this moment, I need to begin to understand irritation. And what is the nature of that? And what is the nature of a relationship when I'm irritable or when my son is irritable? It is learning how to begin to open up into our lives as not being a permanent thing like a noun, but instead it is the possibility of awakening at every moment. It's hard to believe that we could awaken in any moment. But I always remember Ananda, who was Buddha's attendant for his entire monastic life. And Buddha died before Ananda did. Ananda could quote whatever the Buddha said almost word for word. He had whatever it's called when you have perfect memory. And so he could recall whatever the Buddha said with this precision. He understood all the Dhamma and he could quote the Dhamma, and he was in and out of Dhamma, and he knew the Buddha and he was with the Buddha all the time. Surely some of the Buddha's enlightenment rubbed off on him a little bit, just transmitting it. I've been in the room with Philip and I can feel Philip. So there's a way in which you got to be able to feel some of this. But Ananda, all these monks would get enlightened and not Ananda. And then one day after the Buddha died, Ananda was laying down on, he was getting ready to lay down on his bed or mat, and he went to put his head on his pillow. And just as his head hit the pillow, he awakened. He understood. That's how ordinary enlightenment is. We don't talk about it like that. We don't even act as if we believe it's even possible. We kind of practice with all this dukkha. But the possibility of awakening is somewhere on the sideline. But I think the more you practice with devotional practices and rituals, the more you begin to believe it is possible that you could wake up one morning, go get a cup of tea, and as the water is pouring into the teacup, you would awaken and understand. I think it comes from holding everything sacred and not a permanent identified self. It's just sacredness. The second thing is part of what we let go of when we open our eyes is doubt in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And so what we're doing in this practice is that we're actually beginning to see and trust in something that we don't see, something that we don't actually see and believe. I mean, we don't see it. we're used to living in a world where you, if you want to be successful, then you read the books about how, what are the 7 behaviors of successful people? What do people do to be successful? That's how we be successful. I know how to do that. I was telling you last week that I took a whole class on how to learn how to organize and manage high stress caseloads. When you have, you know, 70, 80 trials pending and you got all this work to do on them and all these witnesses and you got to manage all these people, all these documents, all this work. And I had to learn how to organize. I have ADHD, man. Organization and ADD, that doesn't go together. But I learned how to organize because I was taught that. But this practice that we are embarking on is not something we can learn like that. Nobody can teach it like that. We can learn different things to spark our interest, but it really boils down to some given moment. Are you willing to practice with what has come to you? What has arisen in this moment? That's where the practice makes a difference. So we have to trust when we're sitting in meditation with our eyes closed and no one else is with us. We have to trust in the midst of, you know, some reactivity. We have to trust to find our practice in those moments. And in those moments, that's when the practice becomes alive. And so what helps us steady ourselves from the doubt is devotional practices, rituals that we're going to talk about next week. And the last kind of thing that we talked about last week, that practices, sometimes we can get caught in the practice and the devotion itself and think that that is what is going to lead to your, to our awakening. And it's, it really gets bad with the metta practices. We think if I say metta, say metta, say metta, they're going to become a better person. And it's not really like that. Or if I sit and sit and sit and sit and sit, I'm going to be a better person. And it's not like that either. We're saying metta, this loving kindness in order to free ourselves from the moment of constriction that's happening right now. We're not saying metta to make the other person better. We're saying metta so we can stop being so angry with the other person because they're not the way we want them to be. So we're saying the metta to loosen our own hearts, saying we're meditating to see our own greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's not the ritual itself that leads to liberation. It is our wisdom that we see because we do these rituals and the devotion. So I think the way I look at rituals and devotion is like this. Buddha was very clear that to reach some place of awakening is hard. It's hard to see it. It's he said it was sublime, subtle, hard to see. It is. I've been practicing a long time. I'm not awakened. It's not like it hasn't been for a lack of devotion and forthright. It's hard to see. I am definitely wiser than I was before. I have definitely opened my eyes and I can see wisdom at a level I couldn't see it before. But in order for that to happen, I had to look at a lot of dukkha. I have looked at a lot of dukkha, my dukkha, not anybody else's. And so to me, what gets us to be willing to look at our dukkha is the uplift and I don't know, the, it's like Mary Oliver's poem. It's the sacredness of devotion, the uplift of it that brings us to the path that allows us to be willing to look at our dukkha. But once we get to the, once we get to the edge, once we get to the door, once we get to the gate, to the moment where I'm willing to practice, then we got to put our rituals and our devotions down and we got to turn towards dukkha, because dukkha is how we actually open the door. So it's sort of like, to me, the rituals and the devotions is what get us interested and pique our willingness to practice. But once we start practicing, then it's dukkha that actually carries us into liberation. The mindfulness of that dukkha and the noticing where we're clinging and letting it go. Anyway, next week we're going to talk a lot about rituals. I'm going to do some, we're going to do some chanting. I'm just like, this is my last opportunity to do this. So it's my only opportunity to do it. So next week is my week. And it may not be the way we traditionally do Monday nights. I'm just giving you a heads up. There'll be some singing. I'm just giving you a little heads up here. We'll do some chanting and learn some chants and talk about ways that we can bring devotion into our everyday practice. All right? So let's sit just here for a moment, and then we'll take a break. And then we'll kind of divide up a little bit. Okay. We're going to take 5 minutes here and come back at about 10 after 8. Okay. Ken, I'm thinking 20 minutes, groups of threes. How's that sound? Is that doable?
Yep. Just give me another few seconds.
Okay. Well, good, because I'm going to tell everybody what it is that we're going to kind of look into. So I like to offer more than one thing for people to explore. And so you're going to have 20 minutes to explore either what you think about devotion or what your thoughts are about the talk either tonight or last week or even with Carrie and Lindo. Did anything come up for you that maybe strikes you when we think about talking about devotion, something you want to share with someone? Or you could talk about, I don't even do devotion. I'm not devotional. I don't consider myself devotional. I don't even like it. I don't want anything to do with it. And I'm hoping we're not going to turn into some kind of devotional thing. It could be that too. So when we get into these groups, you're going to share, one thing you can share is your what you think about devotional practices. Two, you can just be completely against it, and that's fine too. You can share something that you have heard over the course of this talk or last week or Lindell's or Carrie's, something that struck you about devotional practice. And then just lastly, what it means to you in your life if you are devotional. What does it mean to be devotional? And we're going to hear, everybody has their own understanding of this. Some of you don't like the word devotion, and some people like the word faith, and some people don't like the word faith. And so all of it is open, and we're just listening to two other people and hearing how vast this topic actually is, much vaster than we think. So anytime you're ready, Ken, you can put people in their groups, and then I'll see you in 20 minutes. So we'll see what people thought about what you, you can raise your hand if you want in the, probably raising your hand, it'll be easier for me to see it because I'm looking at a little small screen, or people can raise their hand in the hall here. Just want to see, maybe you're all kind of stoked about next week. I am. Yeah, go ahead. Look at you.
In our group, we talked about how like rituals kind of like set a tone for the day or something like that. Like I had an example of like playing soccer with my friends in the morning and have that like set like a certain tone for my day that like kind of made it seem like I was on track for the day or something.
Yep.
And like my mom just like meditation and stuff to set the tone. And then, well, I think meditation, some other rituals.
Yeah.
Which was really cool. And how it like brings like pause to the day and like lets us like reflect on it.
That's it. That's setting the tone is what I think rituals do. It sets a tone. And, the reason why I think they're so important is because we're going to talk about it next week, but sometimes we have difficult things to face, and wrapping them up in ceremony and ritual helps us have a reminder, I think, that we're practicing. So even though you play soccer in the morning, if your playing isn't always, if it isn't as good as it is some mornings, you're probably pretty limbo and you can just do anything. But some mornings it probably isn't, that this doesn't go right. Things don't hit right. You can't take that ritual, what happens there as who you are. That's what the Dhamma's pointing to, that the ritual helps energize you, but it's not you. It's not setting a tone for who you are, right? So not whether you have a good day practicing, but more that the practicing is what helps you stay alive, upbeat, energy up. Good. Thank you so much for our youngest volunteer. Anybody else?
We got Mary's.
Oh, go ahead, Mary.
Hey, Tori.
Hi.
Thank you. That was a wonderful, wonderful, inspiring comment that was just made. The only thing I have to say is that my little group on Zoom was fantastic. And we were newbies, some of us, not all of us, some of us were newbies. And So the content of the discussion was not completely focused on what the subject to hand is, although it will be more, I'm sure. But the Zoom, the meeting thing was wonderful. And I just have to thank you for that, and thank my mates in the in the Zoom room, because it was absolutely terrific. And I think that we will get to the subject at hand soon, and I look forward to it anyway.
Well, one way you can think of it is we have already a devotional ritualistic practice of having a talk night and then having a discussion night. And then on the discussion night, we break out into groups and talk to each other. And that talking to each other, it doesn't matter so much to me what you talk about, because I know that from hearing the Dhamma and from talking to each other, you are already strengthening each other's practice. And so that's what I mean by devotion is what gets us willing to be in the conversation, and whatever that conversation is fine. It's not a particular thing.
Amen to that. Thank you, Tori.
You're welcome. Oh, you guys are pretty. Oh, go ahead, Dane.
I was wondering about you were talking last week about how everything starts to be viewed as sacred.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, does everything when you're practicing more and more start to feel more sacred?
Or yes.
So just overall, it just creeps more and more and more into your life.
It does if you hold it that way. So I think a lot of people, if you don't, this is a reason why I'm saying that I think devotion gets important. So when you very first come into the practice, it's like you go to a beginning class and you're just trying to get still. So it doesn't feel sacred because you're just trying to be still. So it's really more of trying to figure out how to do this. And it doesn't carry with it a quality of sacred. But after you get past this, the uneasiness about, can I even rest my attention for 2 seconds on the breath? After a while, you stop worrying about that so much. So now you go into this, kind of like learning mode. I just want to learn and learn and learn and learn and study about this list and that list and this list and that list. And you can study, 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 but at some point, the more you study and the more you look at the Dhamma, the more dukkha you see. And you see more of it and more of it and more of it. In order for you to stay with the practice and not think all this dukkha means that I'm really messed up, that is where devotion comes in. Because when you start making everything sacred, then even when you see all your destructive bad habits and all the greed, hatred, and delusion that's showing up in your life, you will not be thrown off by it. And you'll be able to stay with the practice beyond that. So that's why I think it's what keeps you on the path when things get very, very difficult. I think in the beginning, I think we don't know how difficult this path is going to get. Like I've read a lot of articles recently about people who come into mindfulness and they're so disappointed because they come in thinking it's going to really change them. And then they start seeing all these difficulties. But that's because when you start sitting still, that's what you start seeing. So the creating everything as sacred, I think part of it we do as devotional practice, but part of it begins to happen because you start listening to Dhamma talks and you start realizing this is not me. Something else is going on here. You just begin to expand your understanding. But to get you to stay with that difficulty and not sort of shrink away from it, that's what devotion does. That's what creating everything as sacred does. It makes it so that seeing your bad habits is a sign of clinging, but it's not a sign of you somehow being less than. That's what you're looking at. And you have to see it that way so that you're actually willing to work on the clinging and not trying to force yourself to be a better person. You see the difference?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Alan.
Hey, Tori. So I was not looking forward to this group. I almost left because I thought, devotion, what are we going to talk about devotion for, 20 minutes? And I got into it with my group and we were talking. And everyone had a very, very different topic of devotion. But we realized we were all talking about, there's something about here. There's something just very, and what we were saying that was just, we understood what we were talking about, even though it was very different things.
Yep.
And it was very nice.
Yeah, that's very sweet, Ellen. That's why I was saying it's good that people who think, oh no, I don't have any kind of devotional stuff here. It is, this is a heart practice. That's what it is. It's opening our hearts up. And it's hard to open your heart up in a world that is very, very painful. It's very hard to do this. And there has to be some degree of trust that I'm not going to get swallowed up by the pain if I open up the heart. And so how we do that is very different. But we are, as you say, we are all working towards that same thing. And we're all quite devotional. I'm just going to talk about the religious devotion. That's pretty much what I'm going to talk about. But that's just because that is the nature of the way I am. Good. Thanks for sharing that. Oh, yeah, Austin. Oh, sure. We'll bring you the mic here.
I've heard Jack Kornfield and others talk about the one who knows. And there's like a part of me that when I want to show the teacher I'm devoted. I want the rest of the sangha or the congregation to see I'm devoted.
Mm-hmm.
Am I doing this right? Am I devoted? Is this devotion? And having the validation of a teacher or other people to affirm, this is the way. But then what does it mean when you're alone?
Yep.
And you're devoted to practice and there's nobody there observing you or to give validation and there's no teacher. And it's just the one who knows there. What is that knowing?
I think what that knowing is I think that is the faith that devotion kind of creates, practice creates. I don't think it matters whether or not the Sangha thinks you're devoted or whether a teacher thinks you're devoted. Even though I think all of us, I certainly wanted Rodney to believe I was devoted. I certainly wanted the Sangha to think I was. So it's not like I think that we should ignore that. It's part of, I think, this identity, who I am. Oh, I'm a Buddhist or I'm a practitioner. But you're pointing to something that I'm also pointing to, which is, when it really begins, when your practice really begins to settle into a stream of understanding and wisdom, is when that devotion is purely to help you stay with your practice when your eyes are closed. When there's no one else there but you and your own mind and your own body sensations, can you stay in the practice in those times? And that, I think, comes from beginning to practice in a way that I hate to say it like this, but I'm going to say it like this. I think there has to be a bit of humility. We have to be lower than the Dhamma. Our wisdom, our who we are as a being, our ego has to be lower than the Dhamma. And I think that's why there's so much frustration in this practice, and there's so much bowing let me just share a little quick story. One time I was in a training, and there was like 100 of us. And the training first started, it was this first time, it was CDL4, the Community Dharma Leader 4 program in Spirit Rock. And they made a big deal to make it diverse, and it was the biggest diverse group of people, like 50-50, and just, I mean, any kind of diversity you could think of, they had it in that room. And that opening night, we were all like, oh my God, I'm so honored. Oh, I feel so great. I can't believe I got picked to be in this program. It's so beautiful. But by the fourth day, oh yeah, we were ready to pretty much walk out. Everybody was done because we had offended every possible group of people. Somebody offended somebody. So by the fourth day, we're pretty much done. And Tanesara, we're so, okay, so I want you to hear our egos, our self-identity is so high. All the Black people are mad, the gay people are mad, even the people that have difficulties with ableism, they're mad too. Everybody was mad at somebody. And Tanesara, who is, you know, monastic, you know, from the monastic world, she walks into that room with 100 and somewhat angry people ready to quit one morning by herself. So the night before, it was so bad that the teachers told us to go into silence and go to our rooms and settle down. And people were arguing with each other in front of the teachers. They were not going in their rooms, and they were not being quiet, and there was no settling down. That morning, Tanesara walks into that room at 9 o'clock, and she had us start doing this bowing practice. She told us a story of Avalokiteshvara and coming into compassion and Kuan Yin. And then she had us do this bowing practice. It's the bowing practice that we do on the evening of forgiveness. And she had us bow and bow and bow and bow and bow and bow and bow. And she said, we're not bowing to anybody. We're just bowing. That's all you're doing. You're not bowing to anybody. So she had half the room bowing the same way we do it. And then the other half was standing, singing the chant, and the other half would bow. And then the other one would stand and sing the chant. And we did this a good half hour, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. But by the time I had gotten through and she stopped, I had let go of a lot of anger. There was somehow she brought into that space that the practice was greater than we were, and that even though we were all stepping on each other's toes, it didn't mean that we were not strong practitioners and that the practice wasn't there to support us. That we had to be willing, in the midst of our irritation and anger and frustration, were we going to turn towards the practice, or were we going to just stay caught up in all our egos and offenses and who offended who? So all of that bowing is what I think helped us, sort of like when you're behind your own eyelids, that bowing helped us put the Dhamma higher than us. And we got lower and lower and lower to the Dhamma. My ego and my frustration got lower to the Dhamma. And then we began to talk to one another. And that entire, I think, two people did not come back. One, because they lived in Europe and they couldn't stay. And another person because of a change in their work schedule. But pretty much the whole group came back. And I remember having no intentions of coming back the night before Tenesra did all that bowing. I'm like, I don't know what I got myself up into, but I'm leaving. And all that bowing changed all of it, changed our whole disposition, changed who we were, because everybody's bowing, everybody. And somehow we found the interpersonal devotion ourselves. You see, didn't have anything to do with anyone else. Every one of us could have left. She never said, okay, you guys, we need to get along. She never talked about how we're going to get along. She didn't do any of that. She just told the story about Kuan Yin and Avalokiteshvara and started bowing. And by the time we were done, she pretty much brought the whole room back together again. So that's what I think we're doing when we're doing this devotional practice. We are remembering individually that there's something greater than us. And that you have to remember when you're by yourself. You know? Anyway, that was good. I cannot wait until next week. I'm telling you, I'm trying my best to be like, okay, tone it down, Tori. We only have just a short amount of time. But I just want you to be prepared so you know you can come and know what we're going to do. I think we should end with Mary Oliver again. This is out of her book, Blue Horses. I love this book. I love this woman. And it's called The Hummingbirds. She says, in this book, there are many hummingbirds, the blue-throated, the bumblebee, the callipee, the cinnamon, the lucifer, and of course, the ruby-throated. Imagine! Well, that's all you can do, for they're swift as the wind, and they fly not across the pages, but like many shy and otherworldly things, between them. I know you'll keep looking now that I've told you. I'm hungry to see them too, but I can't. I can't hold them back even for a moment. They're busy, as all things are, with their own lives. So all I can do is let you know they're here somewhere. All I can do is tell you by putting your own hunger on the page. I love this. Yeah. Let me read this last part again because I read it wrong. Makes all the difference in the world. It says, I know you'll keep looking now that I've told you. I'm hungry to see them too, but I can't hold them back. Even for a moment, they're busy as all things are with their own lives. So all I can do is let you know they're here somewhere. All I can do is tell you by putting my own hunger on the page. See, so in a way, we kind of put our own hunger for Dhamma out in the ether when we're in Sangha. And that hunger, we all begin to share a little bit of it and start looking. And then we create devotion just by showing up on Monday nights. All right, well, let's sit a moment and I think we'll say goodbye. We don't have any announcements tonight. We'll bring some announcements next week.